You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada, because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade.
On today's episode of From Embers, you'll hear a talk by Alexis Shotwell called What is Food? Veganism and Mutual Aid, recorded at the AKA Autonomous Social Center in Kingston a few weeks ago. Alexis teaches and writes in Ottawa on unceded Algonquin territory, where she's a part of the Punch Up Anarchist Collective, who some of you might remember were featured on an earlier episode of From Embers. She's also the co-investigator for the AIDS Activist History Project, which you can check out at aidsactivisthistory.ca, and author of Knowing Otherwise, Race, Gender, and Implicit Understanding, and Against Purity, Living Ethically in Compromised Times. This talk touches on a few different topics: individual purity practices in the realm of eating, on the distinction between ethical decisions based on substances and ethical decisions based on placing ourselves in relationships, and on exploring how anarchist understandings of mutual aid as a form of political care can help us be in good relationships with our devastated, hurting, good world. I really appreciated this talk, and I was glad for the opportunity to think and talk through what kinds of relations we currently embody and what kinds of relations we strive to embody with animals, humans, and other forms of life on this territory and throughout the world. Only the first part of the talk before the open discussion was recorded. Also, this talk has been edited to remove audience voices, and I've edited and re-recorded questions as well. I've tried to make sure the talk still flows and makes sense. Just know that any awkward cuts or errors in translation are completely my fault. Before we get to the talk, I just wanted to mention a bit about the space that hosted the event. The AKA Autonomous Social Center is both a physical building and meeting slash event slash organizing space, and an organization of local anarchists and anti-authoritarians. In their own words, AKA is a space dedicated to anti-state, anti-capitalist, anti-colonial, and anti-oppression politics and practices. We value community, mutual aid, and solidarity. We value practices where people look out for each other and don't rely on the state to meet our needs, and especially practices that take care of those who need it. We want to neither be dominated nor dominate other people or groups. We believe in our individual and collective freedoms. They're located at 75 Queen Street. It's the red and black house on the corner of Queen and Wellington, and the space has a ramp and a single stall wheelchair accessible bathroom. For those of you in Kingston, if you want to check it out, you can stop by during open hours for Blue Heron Books and Zines, a community bookstore and zine shop located in the AKA, Mondays from 3 to 8 p.m. and Thursdays from 5:30 to 7 p.m. Also, for those of you in Kingston, on April 29th at 6:30 p.m., AKA is hosting another talk in their Applied Anarchy series called The Tyranny of Work. Here's a description. May Day is approaching, and it has some of us thinking about workers and work itself. For many of us, our anxieties about work and our inability to survive without it pervades much of our lives. We schedule our lives around it, spend our lives in school preparing for it, and it often leaves us unable to meet our needs, suffering from chronic stress or physical ailments and dreading each day. In the absence of a coercive capitalist system, what work would we deem necessary or unnecessary? What if we structured work around our lives and not the other way around? And in the present, how do we work in ways that resist oppressive systems, give us control over our lives, and provide for our collective needs? For our April Applied Anarchy discussion, we'll examine the tyranny of work from an anarchist perspective and discuss ways to counter the competitive and individualistic ideology of capitalism with compassion, solidarity, and mutual aid. The Applied Anarchy series is intended to offer informal conversations on real-world topics from an anarchist perspective. All are welcome to stop by and be part of the discussion, and each month focuses on a different topic. Previous topics have included addiction and harm reduction, madness and mental health, food security, surviving the holidays, creating consent culture, and consuming pop culture. If there's a topic you'd like to suggest, or you just want to get in touch, find them on Facebook at AKA Autonomous Social Center, or check out the-aka.ca. Anyway, that's enough from me. Here's Alexis.
So I'm part of a small anarchist collective in Ottawa called Punch Up Collective, and I also teach at Carleton there, and I am a functional potter. Those are things about me. And I've been thinking for a long time about consumption and production. I've been really interested in this question of what it means to always be making ethical decisions with the understanding that we can't be pure, that we are never going to make entirely correct decisions. And I'm really interested in what it means for us to start from there. So to start from the idea that we're always going to make mistakes, and that that's not a problem or a big failing, but actually just the beginning place for how we can do anything in this world. So I'm happy to talk about some of that stuff. This stuff that I want to share with you today came out of basically just trying to think about what it means as someone who eats vegan to be really irritated at other people who eat vegan, what that's about, and also what it means for me to still think that it's reasonable to say we should eat particular ways. So also what it means for me to be like, I would like there not to be suffering in this world. And I've actually taken Buddhist vows to not cause suffering. But these are impossible, right? Like, everyone talks about this. Like, you can't not cause suffering. You turn on the light and you're implicated in horrible things. You eat something, you're implicated in horrible things. You flush the toilet. So it's like trying to think about that. I also have a sort of more academic-y, written out 10-page single space version of this, but I'll just tell you everything that's in it so no one has to figure out. Starting in about 2017, there started to be more and more, and then there was another big push of this, people saying the way for us to fight climate change is to eat vegan and vegetarian. Everyone should do this. So there was like a Nature paper that came out just really recently, and then there was a lot of kerfuffle around that. So a lot of people saying, no, that's not true. Other people saying the best way to save the planet isn't to eat vegan, it's to eat the billionaires. Other people saying, you know, this isn't consistent with... So I've been really interested in that tangle. And one of the things that I also think is interesting is the move that happens so much of the time to look at these big, overwhelming, huge problems, and then to say the solution to these things is for individual people to change their personal lifestyle behavior. So you have this enormous, unmanageable political situation, and you're responsible for it if you don't change the way that you're eating. I think that there is some way that we can be responsible, change certain things about what we do, and still hold in view that the main people that are polluting and killing the world are massive corporations, that, you know, it's not the main plastic in the ocean isn't our water bottles, it's fishing nets. Like all of those things, I think we can hold them in view. So this is what I'm going to try to lay out here tonight. So I think that what we can say is, so what I have, what I'm going to try to do is lay out some of the problems that I think are happening in these big, big complex things, the sort of context. Then I'm going to explain a distinction that I think is really useful between looking at the substance of what we're eating to looking at what the relationships that that substance is. So instead of talking about food as like this is a doll or this is salad, I want us to talk about food as relationships. So that's the kind of thing that I think is useful, and then I'm going to be really curious if you think is useful. And then the last part is going to be saying just talking about relationships doesn't actually get us anywhere in thinking about how we should live. And a good, useful thing that does get us somewhere is talking about this concept of mutual aid. How many people have heard of that idea of mutual aid? Okay, some. Good. Okay, so that's the plan. Does everyone feel okay? All right. So the first thing is, I think there's lots of good reasons that we turn to just like individual practices when we're confronted with really huge things. So one thing is that looking at our individual lifestyle decisions is like a small enough thing that we can actually grapple with it. It's like we feel that there's something impossibly huge because it is. And if we're just looking at our use of plastic or our eating habits, it's small enough that we can do something about it. And that's very powerful, and it's a way that we can actually tune in and hold something in our life that is about being oriented toward wishing that the world wouldn't drown or burn. So we can have some sense of motivation that comes out of attending to our personal practices that maybe is powerful and good for us. It's also, I think, a thing that happens where we might just feel a sense of despair. And like, we're not gonna be able to solve all of that, but we're just gonna kind of try to rearrange the deck chairs as the ship goes down. So that's the kind of more grim version of this. Another version of attending to our own eating is really closely connected to what in gym worlds is called clean eating. So what clean eating usually means is that you're gonna eat low on the chain of complexity and sugars, not have so many processed foods. There's a lot of gym places where you can get like points on apps for eating clean. So, and interestingly, that's also a space where you end up being like doing a personal purity thing where you're eating this animal or this low-carb something, and it's a way that you're keeping your body as a temple and optimizing yourself. I think that there's some way that looking at clean eating projects in gyms as a form of self-optimization isn't actually very far away from trying to be good in our eating in relation to things like climate change. So they're really different motivations. One is trying to save the world. One is trying to have a really excellent body that either can look really great or do really great things. But they're both, I am thinking of them as individual purity practices. Does that make sense to everyone? You don't have to agree with it as a claim, but do you see the thing that's connecting there around those consumption? So then I want to bring in the fact that Jordan Peterson, does anyone not know who Jordan Peterson is? He wears a three-piece suit. He's like a psychology professor at the University of Toronto who's become a kind of pundit on the like edges of the alt-right. So he's like in the classification of what is sometimes being called the intellectual dark web. So people that are trying to argue for a version of the world that is a little bit about individual correctness in a certain way, but very concerned about whether political correctness has gone too far, whether people are being forced to think that the left is correct in universities. Is that inaccurate? Does everyone feel comfortable with the way I'm describing that? So he has started eating a beef-only diet. And there's a whole movement, it turns out, of people who are doing carnivory, so eating basically only meat, and in ways that are allied with sort of some other versions of diets, like keto diets and paleo diets, which also have a sort of narrative that the right way for humans to eat is really a lot of meat, and that this is like we're closer to our civilizational like base. So sometimes people look at that and they say, okay, if the way we're going to solve climate change is by eating vegan, and there are these right-wing folks who are all eating meat, then the reason they're eating meat is because they want to destroy the planet. So what's interesting when you start looking at people that are eating beef-only diets or meat-only diets is quite a lot of them are actually talking about having profound disabilities. So often not diagnosed, like a lot of these diets come out of managing epilepsy. That's the sort of scientific basis for what these diets do, that some of them help manage seizures. But really interestingly, even people like Jordan Peterson and his daughter, Michaela Peterson, what they talk about is experiencing profound physical and mental disability. And the solution for them is that they don't look to the world and say, what's happening that's making me feel this way? They're like, how am I going to personally solve this? No one else is going to help me, so all I can do is eat only beef and salt, and then I'll feel better. So I think this is really fascinating because it changes my own response to them. It changes my response because it makes me feel like this looks to me like just selfishness, right? Like a particular kind of self-involvement. Because, of course, eating clean by eating a lot of meat is just eating things that have been processed through other beings' bodies. So if you're eating a lot of dairy or you're eating a lot of meat, that is a way that things have been processed. It's a processed food, but it's just processed through another animal, right? It's a densification of energy through someone else's labor, in this case, non-human animal labor. So I want us to think about all of those things as being an interesting context in which we make any kind of political claim about food and how we should eat. So things that are surprising to me are sometimes people who are eating meat-only diets or meat-heavy diets, maybe I need to feel more compassion toward them. Sometimes people who are doing things that look opposite are actually having a sort of similar practice with how they're trying to confront complex situations. So I just want to sort of begin, this is the end of part one, being like, everything is complicated. Does anyone want to say anything or ask anything right now?
Veganism and vegetarianism would certainly help the world. And I wouldn't approve of eating only meat. We can definitely help the world just by not eating just meat. Some people do have to eat some meat, so it's not necessary to cut out meat completely. But we definitely shouldn't all be carnivores. We don't need to do that.
Yes, in fact, there's some really profound worries about eating only. Yeah, aside from the political, it's like, I think some profound nutritional needs are not being met.
Quite true, yes. It's not good for us either to only eat meat. It might be good for some people to eat some, but it's surely not good for anyone to eat just meat.
Yes, a lot of the Facebook groups, if you spend time on them, 50% of it is people being like, I've started the meat-only diet, I haven't pooped in 2 weeks. People saying, don't worry, that's fine.
Do you or do other people trust Jordan Peterson to be sincere?
Right, is he actually not eating?
Partly is he only eating beef, although I may be less interested in that than like, maybe this is not a great line of questioning, because if it wasn't Jordan Peterson, I wouldn't interrogate someone's claims this way. But like, are the reasons that he's publicly stating for only eating meat his actual reasons, or are there other cultural or political reasons? Is he dog whistling to super macho dudes to be like, I only eat meat? I don't know. This is just speculation.
I mean, he says a lot of times, like, in when you watch, there's one main interview where he talks about this on the Joe Rogan show. So he talks a lot about how he's lost so much weight. That wasn't his goal. Obviously, he didn't realize he had that much weight to lose. So he's definitely performing a kind of potent masculinity that is, like, super fit and looks better in three-piece suits than it used to. But what's fascinating to me is the two things happening there, this kind of, like, performance of potency and mastery, and there's a long history of, like, men eating only meat as a way to be extra masculine, alongside, and his whole thing in his main book is about how you should master the forces of chaos, which are women, the feminine force, through discipline and control. And what's really interesting to me is, like, during the time that he was writing and promoting that book, as far as I know, he was not talking about having crushing depression, about not being able to, like, get up in the morning, about unbearable joint pain, about a feeling of, like, constant roiling gut. So this kind of space between the competency that is performed as the person who can give you 12 rules for your life and the felt experience that he's now depicting himself having had is really interesting to me. That actually when you listen to him, you're like, oh, you're suffering incredibly. And I don't know if the people that are paying, you know, $77,000 a month to have YouTube conversations with you, so I think there's an interesting story there about, like, vulnerability and masculinity that I don't know enough to tell, but I think there's something, doesn't matter if he's telling the truth in a certain way, but there's something interesting happening there that's revealed through the way he talks about his food needs. I don't know what it means for me to start identifying Jordan Peterson as disabled either.
I think what needs to be known is that vivisection is unscientific, immoral, illegitimate, and physically unsound.
Are you saying, Doctor, that there is no advantage at all in using animals in any kind of medical research?
Not only is there no advantage, but it's dangerous, because the results or the data that comes out of animal experimentation is not apply to human disease.
You're listening to From Embers on CFRC 101.9 FM, or the podcast version, which you can find at fromembers.libsyn.com. And that was A Life's a Life by Disrupt.
Okay, so I want to take up this this question of how should we, of, like, the food and substances. And we all want to, if you need to, like, get up and move around, stim, leave, come back, don't worry, just do so. Okay. Okay, so this is the part where I want to give you it's a little philosophy moment. So there is this term ontology. And ontology just is what something is, the way I'm going to use it right now. What is something? So if we say those are pens, and we say what are they for, what makes them a pen, what makes a pen? You can write with them, you can color with them, right? So a pen's being, the way we're going to use it, is that you can write with it, you can color with it. And if it stops having any ink in it, we might still say that's a pen, but we'd say it's the pen that doesn't work anymore. So it doesn't work as a pen. Okay. So this comes from this philosopher who I think is really great, named Lisa Heldke. And I think it's kind of unfortunate that it's like just in a philosophy journals, because I think it's so useful. So she says, a lot of the time when we're making decisions about what we eat, we think that the way for us to make that decision is by using a substance ontology. So that means we say, I'm going to eat this and not this based on what the thing is. So if we're vegetarians, what are the substances we don't eat?
Meat.
We're vegans, meat, dairy products. If we're eating gluten-free, we don't eat?
Wheat.
Yes, or barley or triticale. So those are all substance ontologies. The decision is based on what the thing is. Okay, so Lisa Heldke says, but what's weird about this is, she says, as a vegetarian, why, if I'm just using my vegetarian hat, why is it okay for me to eat chocolate that is produced using child slavery? Like, there's nothing in my vegetarian substance. It's a vegetarian thing, so I should be able to eat it. So she says, I became really dissatisfied with my own ethical, naming my ethical thing vegetarian, because I wanted there to be a way for me to say, I'm taking an ethical approach to my food that included the kids picking and processing chocolate. I think this is brilliant. So she says, actually what we need is a relational ontology of food. So we shouldn't think that food is that thing and make a decision based on what that thing is. We should be thinking about what relationship we're in when we eat that food. Okay, so the way that this is really interesting is food is always a relationship. So we know that we're being eaten by various critters in our gut and by, like little microscopic critters on our skin. And they help us tremendously, right? So our microbiome, the colonies and ecosystems of critters in our gut and on our skin, is the reason that we don't get so many infections. It's the reason that we have, the capacity to digest anything. There's so many interesting things about this. So we have all these relationships. We're being eaten, and we're also eating things. And some of the things that we're eating, we're not actually eating for ourselves. We're eating because the colony of microbes in our gut likes those things. And then they do other things that help us out. So when we start really looking, we're like, whoa, there's actually so many relationships of eating and being eaten here that we just don't look at very often. So just being food is about that, to eat and be eaten, just as a basic thing. But if you start having a relational ontology of food, all of a sudden, you also start being able to say, I'm trying to eat ethically based on looking at my relationships. And all of a sudden, you're able to say, and therefore, I don't eat factory farmed meat because I don't want to stand in that relationship. And that means I don't want to stand in that relationship to those animals and the lives they've lived. And I'm also profoundly concerned about the workers who are working in slaughterhouses, who have tremendous trauma, who lose limbs, who get carpal tunnel syndrome. If you have a relational ontology, all of a sudden, you can say, I'm not going to eat Driscoll raspberries during this time when the workers are on strike. The raspberries didn't change, but our relationship to the raspberries changed because of the workers. So it's not the thing that you're eating, it's the relationship you're eating. The last way I find this such a useful thing for us as trying to think about ethical eating is that all of a sudden, settlers don't have to have opinions about Indigenous people eating seal meat. Like, all of a sudden, settlers don't have to talk about... So, vegan settlers like me don't need to be like, that's wrong for Cookham Kitchen in Toronto to serve seal meat. I can just be like, those are not relations that I'm engaged in. Because my relationship is partly about my being. So who am I? What culture do I come from? What practices does that culture rely on? Right? So when we talk about relationships, it's also about our whole context, our whole history. And so simultaneously, settler fish eaters now no longer have to say, Indigenous people thank the deer who's offered itself to them while they're eating, you know, some like factory farmed tilapia from China. Because that relationship doesn't apply to your fish from China. Does that part make sense? So if you have a relational ontology, it liberates us from a certain kind of... So it still means that settlers who don't have any particular relationship with these animals or these things, we can still comment on each other's eating practices. So if you want to be judgy...
About other people's eating practices, you still can, but it's...
All about what the relationship is that the eating is tracking. Okay, does that part make sense? Because I feel like this is one of the most useful things that I've found for thinking about my own eating politics in a really long time. And is that clear?
In regard to your last comment about how we can still be judgy to settlers, can you just expand a bit on that?
So, like, if I'm talking to someone who's eating only meat because they have epilepsy and it's the only way they're managing their illness. I'm going to say, I don't stand in that relation to you, right? Like, that's going to be, or like, I honor that that's what you need to do for your health. So this is like what you were saying about, like, some people need to, or people who are like, I really become profoundly anemic, and the only thing that makes me not anemic is meat. Like, those things are going to be. But if I'm talking to someone who's just like, I don't care about those animals, those workers, the E. coli that is spread all over the fields, I just really like having a steak, then I might be like, so really the only thing that you care about is your own pleasure, and you don't think that it matters at all, the social conditions that that pleasure is produced in. I think that's wrong. And then we can have actually an interesting conversation, because even people that say that, usually if you say to them, okay, so how would you feel if meat tasted slightly better if you brutally tortured the animal before you, you know, most of them would be like, oh no, I'm not into brutal torture, right? Like, so they also have an ethical line that is about the relationship that they're willing to be in, right? Like, most people are like, no, I don't want terrible things to happen, right? Like, so that's also really, there's much more space to talk if we think about it not in terms of the thing, but in terms of the relationship that they want to stand in.
I don't know how to phrase this, but the thing about tilapia in China and thanking the animals, I got a bit lost in there.
Oh yeah, sorry. That was because I was getting so vehement. A decent amount of the time when I'm talking to people who eat meat, they say, humans are meant to eat meat. And the justification they give for making that claim is they say, look at the native people. And they can't actually ever name an actual person that they're thinking about, right? They just have this idea that native people hunt and they ask the deer to lay down her life or his life, and the deer comes and offers themselves. And so I think that this, if we think about relational ontologies, it's probably a wrong view anyway, in a certain way, and if you want to see it, really interesting Mi'kmaq scholar Margaret Robinson, who's talking about different ways to think about Indigenous veganism, and when is it appropriate to ask a friend to kill themselves for you to survive, which is what a lot of the Mi'kmaq stories anyway are about like friends being like, look, one of us is gonna die, you can eat me, it's okay. So that's actually a really serious relationship, and it's also not a relationship that settlers stand in with those. We don't inherit those relationships to moose or to deer in that way. We might have different relationships with animals, but if you're saying that the reason you feel good about eating meat is because of some amorphous idea of native relationships with animals, it's just not your relationship, so you don't have to stand in it. You know? Does that make better sense?
And because the fish in China, you couldn't have a relationship.
You don't have a relationship. Or you do have a relationship, but then you're in a relationship with that global supply chain of fish. Yeah. How's everyone doing?
When you eat meat, well, the truth would be, who you eat will have to die so you can eat him or her, of course. So, it may not sound good, but yeah, Native people did that, so it's been done since time immemorial. So, yeah, it is a case where I have to die or you have to die so I can eat you, basically.
Yeah, and nothing that we eat is free from death. So, it's a lie to say that any food is not enmeshed in death. So there's also some really interesting questions to ask about the scale of death. So if we say, look, we're part of a world in which lots of little bugs get killed to produce the vegetables that I eat, like processing rice kills a lot of weevils. So I don't believe that small things seek death any more than big things. So one other thing that thinking relationally about our food practices lets us do is to be honest that we're just making decisions about what deaths we're going to stand in relation to in order to eat, in order to live. And that means that we're in the space of ethics.
I'm just wondering if you think that same approach could apply, for instance, to the microfibers in clothing? Or is there something special about thinking relationally about food as opposed to other things we consume?
No, I think we could have relational ontologies about all kinds of consumption and waste practices. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's really compelling. We could think about like what is a relational... So, and the other thing that's interesting about it is still okay for us to say, I eat this stuff and not this stuff. Or I buy only cotton clothing, cotton, hemp. I buy only clothing that can decompose. Those look like substance ontologies. But the interesting thing is, I think most substance ontologies actually are relational ontologies. They're just shorthands. They're just trying to, and we need to do that as humans. Like, we need to have a classification where we're like, I'm not going to just endlessly think about the chains of connection that I'm enmeshed in because I just need to make dinner. So we should probably have some, like, I'm trying not to buy, you know, Lycra clothing because it breaks down into microfibers. That looks like a substance ontology, but if you scratch it a little bit, it's a relational decision. Which is why I still describe myself as eating vegan. So it sounds like a substance, but I think of it as a relationship.
Take.
and we just heard Potemkin City Limits by Propagandhi.
Okay, so the third part, last part, is, but look, just saying that we're in a relationship doesn't give us any guidance about what kind of relationship to be in. Like, there's nothing inherent in saying we're in a relationship that says, and this is how I'm going to pursue this relationship instead of this relationship, or this is the way I'm going to be in relationship. And so this is where I think this concept from anarchist ethics called mutual aid is really great. So anyone who knows that term, does anyone want to say what you think of when you think of mutual aid? Do you know it? Sharing?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sharing what you have?
Yeah.
Sometimes people say giving other people what you can give and receiving from them what you need. Sometimes a shorthand for it. Helping each other out, right? That's how we think about it a lot of the time.
Yo, those are all good.
Yeah. Do you want to say more?
A friend of mine says that instead of there being money, we should take care of each other, which I think is true. Like, could have society take what you need, share what you have. Well, between two people, you can give what you have, they can give you what you need that they have.
And how can we do that on a societal level? That's the question of mutual aid. So there's a, if you want to get nerdy, there's a book called Mutual Aid by Peter Kropotkin. He was a geographer, biologist, social theory guy. And he basically was like, okay, so Darwin had this theory of evolution, which was the survival of the fittest. And Kropotkin's like, Darwin made just this little mistake, which is that he was looking at the Galapagos Islands, which are incredibly dense. And it looked to Darwin like every individual was competing with every other individual and that's what evolution was like. But Kropotkin's like, look, but when I go out and I'm looking at these herd animals on the steppes of Siberia, it's completely evident to me that they are helping each other. As a group, they are helping each other. And he has this very sweet bit where he's like, when our instruments become good enough, because he's in the 19th century, that's how he talks, I believe that we will see that even the smallest microbes also are helping each other. So he's basically like, yes, evolution means survival of the fittest. But survival of the fittest means what groups can help each other most. It's survival of the strongest groups, which is the groups that are most generous to each other. Generosity is the basis of evolution. So this is like a core anarchist principle, that like if we're offering to each other, we are stronger than if we try to just be taking care of ourselves personally. And I've been doing this work with Ursula Le Guin, who is a science fiction author, and her conception of mutual aid, which I think is really rich. And I'm just going to tell you a little bit about how she talks about it, because I think she's on purpose elaborating Kropotkin. And I think I won't read you all these quotes. But basically, she has this one book in particular called The Dispossessed, and it's a kind of study of an anarchist society in a science fiction mode. How many people have read The Dispossessed? Okay, a few. So so I'll just say the things that I think she's arguing, and then if there are Ursula Le Guin nerds, we can get into some of the details of why I think this. So I think there's three things that Ursula Le Guin says about mutual aid that nuance and deepen Kropotkin's understanding. The first one is that all of us actually come into this world and should understand ourselves as living in this world, basically with nothing that is permanently our own. Our freedom is that all we have to offer is ourselves, and that's actually really wonderful. That we can offer ourselves to the world. Okay, so that's part one. Our freedom is offering ourselves. And opening other people's freedom to them, giving them the option, the capacity to open themselves and offer themselves. Second, there's this insight or this understanding or this claim that strength comes from sociability and mutuality, and that once we're talking about sociability and mutuality, then we always have to talk about ethics. We always have to talk about why we're going to do one thing and not another. And third, and I think this is really interesting and an important innovation that Le Guin says, she frames it in the book as the cellular function of an individual. So she says, this is in the part where the main one of the main characters is trying to think about what it means that he wants to do like higher order theoretical physics that doesn't seem to have a practical use in his society, but it's what he's really good at. And he's really struggling because he feels like maybe he's egoizing. He's being really self-involved to want to do theoretical physics. And he has this, and he's kind of, he has this revelation that the only way that society transforms, the only way that it evolves, the only way that it manifests its strength and sociability is through individuals, because there's no such thing as society that isn't made up of people and beings. So Le Guin says, the way that we can understand this is that society has to flourish through individuals flourishing in their cellular function. So their own, what makes them best themselves and what they best have to offer. Society is there for that. That's what society is. It's to allow us to be that way. And in other books, she talks about this as basically being that our freedom lies in our capacity to become something that we didn't know already we could be. So to surprise ourselves, to be something that we haven't yet mastered. So that's a very lovely understanding of what mutual aid is and why, but also why we can nourish ourselves ethically, that's actually a responsibility we have. So the last thing that I think is wonderful that Le Guin says, and this is in a short story that comes, it's set before that novel, she talks about sort of the anarchist thinker who is the intellectual basis for the society in that novel. And there's this line where this person, Odo, is thinking to herself, she wants to not go and meet someone who's come to talk with her. She's old, she's dying, and she's tired, and she doesn't want to go meet this person who's like starstruck and wants to see her. And she says to herself, an anarchist is one who, choosing, takes responsibility for the choice. So that's also about mutual aid. So what can we take responsibility for? What do we choose? And what follows from that choice? So I think if we think huge, complex things that can't be solved by any individual person all by yourself, we can think about relationships, not about substances. Thinking about mutual aid, I think, opens a way that we orient what choices we make and what relationships we decide to stand in. So I think thinking about mutual aid as a key for us for understanding what food is means that we start thinking about what we're taking in, but also how we're putting things out. So how do we have an ethical relationship to our gut? How is that not different than having an ethical relationship to an ecosystem? What ecosystems can we stand in relation to? So it gives us a kind of guide toward how we're thinking about why we do what we do and how we can take responsibility for whatever we can take responsibility for. So I think we can think about mutual aid as a kind of political caring, a situated practice of political caring. And I think it illuminates something. It opens, for me anyway, a way to not despair. Like a way to not feel like we should just give up on everything. I think a lot about this bumper sticker that I used to see when I lived in Santa Cruz that said, save the planet, kill yourself. You know, just the grimness of the impossible. Like, I understand the despair because everything feels really hard, and especially it doesn't feel like eating differently is really going to do anything. So then I think there's also this piece of saying, what happens if we start relating to the way that we be in relation to the world as something where we're always orienting over and over again, starting over and over again, with this sense that we do wish to give what we can and receive what we need. So it is that we're in this incredibly generous world. Like, the sun pours down, the food exists, we eat it. So lovely, right? So how can we have that be something that actually sparks us toward also forming different kinds of relationships, which I think will have to be collective, in public, caring, nourishing, changing, making a stronger thing for everyone, but that also nourishes our cellular function, our capacity to flourish. So that's my pitch. I talked along. Does anyone want to clarify anything about that idea of mutual aid? Or any of the, like...
It's not just within one's own group that mutual aid works. Kropotkin and theorists since that have also talked about interspecies cooperation and how that helps both groups in terms of, like, nitrogen fixing bacteria and plants and how they work together, or how wolves cull the wheat caribou and how that actually makes the caribou healthier. It's a small point, but I feel like it's important to think about those relationships because it continues to break down the idea that our cooperation has to only be with things or people that are like us, but also across species and across difference.
Yeah, and I think that's really important too, because there's this beautiful book, Breeding Sweetgrass, and the Kemmerer, Robin Kemmerer, says at the beginning, she teaches ecology, indigenous ecologies, and she's like, I always start off by asking my students, you know, what examples they have of humans helping the world. And they can't think of a single one, like they just think humans are destructive. And she's like, this is profoundly sad because it's profoundly sad, but also it's not true. Humans can be in good relation to the world. It's just lots of us aren't right now. And she has this line that is, all flourishing is mutual, which is, I think, so nice, right? And it also in line with, like, yeah, you can actually be in good relation. So there's also these interesting, I mean, everything from, like, the reason that we have placentas and can literally reproduce as humans is because we made a bond with a virus a long, long time ago. Like, we have all these viral cells in placentas. So, like, things like that. Kropotkin, so sweet. You can just picture him being, like, happy about that. But then also things like, you know, surprising stuff, like in looking at coral reef degradation, which is so tragic right now. Some of the coral reefs that are doing best are the ones that are most managed by humans. Completely counterintuitive, like doesn't fit any of the narratives, but actually, like, there's this possibility that caring more helps in the context of massive human-caused degradation. So then it's like, what can we actually know we can do? But yeah, when we look, there's lots of, that's all there is actually.
That's all for today. Thanks for listening. If you liked what you heard and want to hear more, we're broadcasting on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston every Wednesday night from 8 to 9 p.m., or you can subscribe and download the podcast version of From Embers wherever you listen to podcasts. We're also part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network, so check out channelzeronetwork.com for more great anarchist podcasts. As always, if you've got questions, feedback, show ideas, or you just want to chat, you can email us at fromembers@riseup.net. See you next week.
In this story, when you hear this, turn the page. Let's begin now.